forced adjournment against the will of the delegates, Wallace would have become president in 1945, and the course of history would have been dramatically altered. In fact, had that happened, there might have been no atomic bombings, no nuclear arms race, and no Cold War. Wallace was far ahead in the initial balloting, but the bosses further restricted admission and made the requisite backroom deals. Truman finally prevailed on the third ballot. Ambassadorships, postmaster jobs, and other positions were offered. Cash payoffs were made. Bosses called every state chairman, telling them that the fix was in and Roosevelt wanted the Missouri senator as his running mate. On Roosevelt's urging, Wallace agreed to remain in the cabinet as Secretary of Commerce. Jackson apologized to Pepper the next day. "I knew if you made the motion," he explained, "the convention would nominate Henry Wallace. I had strict instructions from Hannigan not to let the convention nominate the vice president last night. So I had to adjourn the convention in your face. I hope you understand." What I understood, Pepper wrote in his autobiography, was that, for better or worse, history was turned topsy-turvy that night in Chicago. Meanwhile, the bomb project was progressing rapidly. Scientists, still worried that they might trail the Germans, worked feverishly on two types of atom bombs, one using uranium, the other plutonium. It was not until late 1944 that the Allies discovered that Germany had abandoned its bomb research in 1942. Although the original rationale for the bomb project, as a deterrent to a German bomb, no longer applied, only one scientist, Polish-born Joseph Rotblat, left the Manhattan Project at that point. The rest, fascinated by the research and believing they could speed the end of the war, pushed even harder to finish what they had started. If Wallace's ouster from the ticket represented the first major setback to hopes for a peaceful post-war world, fate would soon deliver a second devastating blow. On April 12, 1945, with German surrender imminent, the United States' beloved wartime leader, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, passed away after more than 12 years in office. The longest-serving president in U.S. history, he had seen the country through its hardest times, the Great Depression and World War II. The nation mourned and wondered about Roosevelt's successor. Events unfolded at a dizzying pace over the next 4 months, forcing the new president to make some of the most momentous decisions in the nation's history. After an emergency cabinet meeting on April 12th, Secretary of War Henry Stimson finally let Truman in on the bomb secret. Truman received a fuller briefing the following day from Burns, his old Senate mentor, whom Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal had flown up from South Carolina in his private plane. A former Supreme Court justice, Burns had expected the vice presidential nomination in 1944, but party leaders considered his staunch segregationist views too great a liability. At that meeting, Burns told Truman that the United States was building an explosive great enough to destroy the whole world. Truman received a fuller briefing on the atom bomb on April 25th from Stimson and Groves. They explained that they expected, within 4 months, to have completed the most terrible weapon ever known in human history, one bomb of which could destroy a whole city. Soon, other nations would develop their own bombs. The world in its present state of moral advancement, compared with its technical development, would be eventually at the mercy of such a weapon. In other words, modern civilization might be completely destroyed. They warned that the fate of humanity would depend upon if and how such bombs were used, and what was subsequently done to control them. In an account of the meeting published posthumously by his daughter, Truman wrote, "Stimson said gravely that he didn't know whether we could or should use the bomb, because he was afraid that it was so powerful that it could end up destroying the whole world. I felt the same fear." Caught between the advancing Soviet troops who had entered Berlin from the east and the Allied forces approaching from the west, Germany surrendered on May 7th. That meant that the Soviet Union, as agreed at Yalta, would enter the Pacific War around August 7th, almost 3 months before the November 1st start date for the invasion of Japan. Japanese soldiers fought fiercely and valiantly. Few ever surrendered. They believed that death on the battlefield would bring the highest honor, eternal repose at Yasukuni Shrine. A Tarawa, of 2,500 Japanese defenders, only 8 were taken alive. In just 5 weeks of combat at Iwo Jima, 6,281 U.S. sailors and Marines were killed, and almost 19,000 wounded. At Okinawa, the biggest battle of the Pacific War, 13,000 Americans were killed or missing, and 36,000 wounded. As many as 70,000 Japanese soldiers and more than 100,000 Okinawan civilians died, many of them taking their own lives. Americans were also shocked to watch wave after wave of kamikaze pilots suicidally crash their planes in a last-ditch effort to sink or damage U.S. ships. As prospects worsened in 1945, some Japanese leaders began calling loudly for 100 million deaths with honor, preferring that the nation fight to the death rather than surrender. But U.S. top leaders, including Marshall and Stimson, dismissed such rantings, remaining convinced that when defeated, Japan would surrender. The proposed program for Japan that Stimson presented to Truman in early July stated that despite Japan's capacity for fanatical resistance to repel an invasion, he believed that Japan is susceptible to reason in such a crisis to a much greater extent than is indicated by our current press and other current comment. Japan is not a nation composed wholly of mad fanatics of an entirely different mentality from ours. The debate over just how costly an invasion would have been has raged for decades. The joint staff planners prepared a paper for the Joint Chiefs' June 18th meeting with the president, estimating 193,500 dead and wounded in taking Japan. Some estimates were higher, some lower. Truman initially said that thousands would have died, but then steadily raised the number. He later claimed that Marshall had told him that 500,000 men could be lost in an invasion. But the basis for this assertion has never been found. Marshall's own estimates were much lower, as were those of General MacArthur, who was in charge of planning for the invasion. But as the war dragged on month after bloody month, the prospects for an invasion dimmed. By the end of 1944, the Japanese Navy was decimated, having lost 7 of 12 battleships, 19 of 25 aircraft carriers, 103 of 160 submarines, 31 of 47 cruisers, and 118 of 158 destroyers. The Air Force was also badly weakened. With the rail system in tatters, food supplies shrank and public morale plummeted. Some Japanese leaders feared a popular uprising. Prince Fumimaro Konoe, who had served 3 times as prime minister between 1937 and 1941, sent a memo to Emperor Hirohito in February 1945. "I regret to say that Japan's defeat is inevitable," he warned. "What we must worry about is a communist revolution that might accompany defeat." Since at least the previous August, in the aftermath of the U.S. victory at Saipan, Japan had quietly commenced studies on how to end the war. Japanese desperation was growing by the day, as was apparent to publishing magnate Henry Luce, who visited the Pacific for a first-hand look in spring 1945. He wrote, "A few months before Hiroshima, I was with Admiral Halsey's Navy as it assaulted the coast of Japan. 2 things seemed clear to me, as they did to many of the top fighting men I talked to. First, that Japan was beaten. Second, that the Japanese knew it and were every day showing signs of increasing willingness to quit." Even Richard Frank, whose book, Downfall, presents the most authoritative defense of the atomic bombings, observed, "It is reasonable to assume that even without atomic bombs, the destruction of the rail transportation system, coupled to the cumulative effects of the blockade and bombardment strategy, would have posed a severe threat to internal order, and subsequently thus impelled the emperor to seek to end the war. Why then, if Japan was not a nation of suicidal fanatics, and its prospects for military victory had vanished, did its leaders not surrender and ease the suffering of their soldiers and citizens? The answer to that lies, in large measure, in the U.S. surrender terms, though the emperor and his advisers must bear their share of the blame. At Casablanca in January 1943, President Roosevelt called for the unconditional surrender of Germany, Italy, and Japan. He later claimed to have done so spontaneously, catching even Churchill by surprise. In a letter to his biographer, Robert Sherwood, Churchill supported that interpretation. "I heard the words unconditional surrender for the first time from the president's lips at the news conference." Though unconditional had not been included in the official communique of the press conference, it had clearly been discussed beforehand and agreed upon by Roosevelt and Churchill. The ramifications of adhering to that demand would be enormous. The Japanese assumed that unconditional surrender meant the destruction of the Kokutai, imperial system, and the likelihood that the emperor would be tried as a war criminal and executed. For most Japanese, such an outcome was too terrible to contemplate. They had been worshipping the emperor almost as a god since Jimmu in 660 BC. A study by MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Command explained, "To dethrone or hang the emperor would cause a tremendous and violent reaction from all Japanese. Hanging of the emperor to them would be comparable to the crucifixion of Christ to us. All would fight to die like ants." Realizing that, many urged Truman to soften the surrender terms. Acting Secretary of State Joseph Grew, who had previously served as ambassador to Japan and knew the Japanese better than any other top administration official, wrote in April 1945, "Surrender by Japan would be highly unlikely, regardless of military defeat, in the absence of a public undertaking by the president that unconditional surrender would not mean the elimination of the present dynasty if the Japanese people desire its retention." Grew joined with Stimson, Forrestal, and Assistant Secretary of War John McCloy in urging Truman to change the surrender terms. U.S. military leaders also felt strongly about the wisdom of giving the Japanese assurances about the emperor. Admiral Leahy told a June meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that he feared that "our insistence on unconditional surrender would result only in making the Japanese desperate and thereby increase our casualty lists." U.S. officials understood how critical the question of surrender terms was to the Japanese, because they had broken Japanese codes even before the United States entered the war, and were intercepting Japanese communications that repeatedly emphasized the surrender issue. In May, Japan's Supreme War Council met in Tokyo. The council, also known as the Big Six, consisted of Prime Minister Kentaro Suzuki, Foreign Minister Shigenori Togo, Army Minister Korechika Anami, Army Chief of Staff Yoshijiro Umezu, Navy Minister Mitsumasa Yonai, and Navy Chief of Staff Soemu Toyoda. They decided to solicit the help of the Soviet Union to get better surrender terms from the United States, offering the USSR territorial concessions in return. Japan's initial contacts were enough to convince Soviet officials that the Japanese were looking for a way out of the war. That news did not please the Soviet leaders, who wanted to secure the concessions the Allies had promised in return for the Soviets entering the Pacific War, which was still a couple months off. On June 18th, the emperor informed the Supreme War Council that he favored quick restoration of the peace. The council concurred, agreeing to ascertain the Soviet Union's willingness to broker a surrender that would safeguard the emperor and preserve the imperial system. A series of cables in July from Foreign Minister Togo in Tokyo to Ambassador Naotaki Sato in Moscow made that crystal clear. On July 12th, Togo cabled Sato, "It is His Majesty's heart's desire to see the swift termination of the war. However, As long as America and England insist on unconditional surrender, our country has no alternative but to see it through in an all-out effort for the sake of survival and the honor of the homeland. The following day, Togo cabled, "His Majesty the Emperor, mindful of the fact that the present war daily brings greater evil and sacrifice upon the peoples of all the belligerent powers, desires from his heart that it may be quickly terminated." Despite the mounting evidence that changing surrender terms could bring the war to a swift end, Truman listened instead to Burns, who insisted that the American public would not tolerate compromising surrender terms, and warned the president that he would be crucified politically if he tried. Though dropping two atomic bombs on an already defeated nation in order to avoid domestic political repercussions would seem morally reprehensible under any circumstances, there was little reason to think that Truman would have had to pay a price for letting the emperor remain on the throne. In fact, Republican leaders had provided Truman all the political cover he needed. On July 2, 1945, Senate Minority Leader Wallace White, a Republican from Maine, addressed his Senate colleagues, urging President Truman to clarify what he meant by unconditional surrender, in the hope of expediting Japan's surrender. If Japan ignored or rejected the president's offer to surrender on more favorable terms, he reasoned, it will not have increased our losses or otherwise have prejudiced our cause. Much might be gained by such a statement. Nothing could be lost. White's Republican colleague from Indiana, Homer Capehart, held a press conference later that day to support White's request. Capehart informed the press that the White House had received an offer by Japan to surrender solely on the grounds that Emperor Hirohito not be deposed. "It isn't a matter of whether you hate the Japs or not. I certainly hate them. But what's to be gained by continuing a war when it can be settled now on the same terms as 2 years from now?" In a June editorial, The Washington Post condemned unconditional surrender as a fatal phrase that was conjuring up such fears among the Japanese people that it was proving an impediment to ending the fighting. Changing the surrender terms was not the only way to expedite Japanese surrender without using atomic bombs. What the Japanese dreaded above all else was the Soviet Union's entry into the war. In early April 1945, the Soviet Union informed Japan that it was not renewing the 1941 Neutrality Pact, raising Japanese fears that the Soviets would declare war. All parties understood what that would mean. On April 11th, the Joint Intelligence Staff of the Joint Chiefs predicted, "If at any time the USSR should enter the war, all Japanese will realize that absolute defeat is inevitable." In May, Japan's Supreme War Council drew a similar conclusion. "At the present moment, when Japan is waging a life-or-death struggle against the U.S. and Britain, Soviet entry into the war will deal a death blow to the empire." On July 6th, the Combined Intelligence Committee issued a top-secret report on the Estimate of the Enemy Situation for the Combined Chiefs of Staff, who would be meeting at Potsdam. The section assessing the possibility of surrender described the effect Soviet entry would have on the already hopeless Japanese. "The Japanese ruling groups are aware of the desperate military situation and are increasingly desirous of a compromise peace, but still find unconditional surrender unacceptable. The basic policy of the present government is to fight as long and as desperately as possible in the hope of avoiding complete defeat and of acquiring a better bargaining position in a negotiated peace. We believe that a considerable portion of the Japanese population now consider absolute military defeat to be probable. The increasing effects of sea blockade and cumulative devastation wrought by strategic bombing, which has already rendered millions homeless and has destroyed from 25% to 50% of the built-up areas of Japan's most important cities, should make this realization increasingly general. An entry of the Soviet Union into the war would finally convince the Japanese of the inevitability of complete defeat. Although individual Japanese willingly sacrifice themselves in the service of the nation, we doubt that the nation as a whole is predisposed toward national suicide. The Japanese believe, however, that unconditional surrender would be the equivalent of national extinction. The Japanese Kitsugo strategy entailed preparing for an Allied invasion with the hope of inflicting such heavy casualties that the war-weary Allies would offer more lenient surrender terms. Japanese leaders had correctly identified Kyushu as the intended landing site and beefed up their forces. Civilians armed with sharpened bamboo spears were instructed to fight to the death along with the soldiers. Clearly, U.S. leaders knew that retention of the emperor was the main obstacle to Japanese surrender, and that the dreaded Soviet entry was drawing closer. Why, under those circumstances, would the United States use two atomic bombs against an almost helpless population? To make sense of that, one has to understand the moral climate within which that decision was made. Americans felt a profound hatred toward the Japanese. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Alan Nevins wrote after the war, "Probably in all our history, no foe has been so detested as were the Japanese." Whereas U.S. wartime propaganda took pains to differentiate between evil Nazi leaders and good Germans, no such distinction was made among the Japanese. As Newsweek reported in January 1945, "Never before has the nation fought a war in which our troops so hate the enemy and want to kill him." Historian John Dower has shown that Americans thought of the Japanese as vermin, cockroaches, rattlesnakes, and rats. Simian imagery abounded. Admiral William Bull Halsey, commander of the South Pacific Force, was notorious in this regard, urging his men forward to kill the yellow monkeys and get some more monkey meat. People questioned whether the Japanese were really human. Time wrote, "The ordinary, unreasoning Jap is ignorant. Perhaps he is human. Nothing indicates it." The British Embassy in Washington reported back to London that the Americans viewed the Japanese as a nameless mass of vermin, and the ambassador described Americans' universal exterminationist anti-Japanese feeling. When popular war correspondent Ernie Pyle was transferred from Europe to the Pacific in February 1945, he observed, "In Europe, we felt that our enemies, horrible and deadly as they were still people. But out here, I soon gathered that the Japanese were looked upon as something subhuman and repulsive, the way some people feel about cockroaches or mice." Some of this sentiment can certainly be attributed to racism. But other powerful forces were also at work in producing this hatred of the Japanese. Even before the United States entered the war, Americans had heard about Japanese bombing, rape, and brutality toward the Chinese, especially in Nanjing. Americans' rancor toward Japan soared with the sneak attack at Pearl Harbor. Then, in early 1944, the government released information about the sadistic treatment of U.S. and Filipino prisoners during the Bataan Death March 2 years earlier. Soon, stories about unspeakable Japanese cruelty, torture, crucifixion, castration, dismemberment, beheading, burning and burying alive, vivisection, nailing prisoners to trees and using them for bayonet practice, flooded the media. Hence, what had been anger toward the Japanese earlier in the war turned to abject hatred, just as U.S. military action was heating up in the Pacific. But President Truman's bigotry toward Asians long antedated reports of Japanese savagery. As a young man courting his future wife, he wrote, "I think one man is as good as another, so long as he's honest and decent, and not a nigger or a Chinaman. Uncle Will says that the Lord made a white man of dust, a nigger from mud, then threw up what was left and it came down a Chinaman. He does hate Chinese and Japs. So do I. It is race prejudice, I guess." Truman regularly referred to Jews as kikes, to Mexicans as greasers, and to other groups with equally derogatory names. His biographer, Merle Miller, reported, "Privately, Mr. Truman always said nigger. At least he always did when I talked to him." Truman's racism notwithstanding, It is right to criticize Japan's unconscionable behavior during the war. However, it is also worth noting that Americans often behaved wretchedly as well. U.S. Pacific War correspondent Edgar Jones detailed U.S. atrocities in a February 1946 article in the Atlantic Monthly. What kind of war do civilians suppose we fought anyway? We shot prisoners in cold blood, wiped out hospitals, strafed lifeboats, killed or mistreated enemy civilians, finished off the enemy wounded, tossed the dying into a hole with the dead, and in the Pacific, boiled the flesh off enemy skulls to make table ornaments for sweethearts, or carved their bones into letter openers. Racism also reared its ugly head in the treatment of people of Japanese descent living in the United States when the war broke out. Japanese Americans had faced discrimination in voting, jobs, and education for decades. The Immigration Act of 1924 denied Japanese who had settled in the United States after 1907 the right to become naturalized U.S. citizens and prohibited further immigration from Japan. Even before Pearl Harbor, some on the West Coast began conjuring up fanciful scenarios of Japanese-American sabotage in the event of war. One journalist wrote, "When the Pacific Zero Hour strikes, Japanese-Americans will get busy at once. Their fishing boats will sow mines across the entrances of our ports. Mysterious blasts will destroy Navy shipyards and flying fields and part of our fleet. Japanese farmers, having a virtual monopoly of vegetable production in California, will send their peas and potatoes and squash full of arsenic to the markets." Following Pearl Harbor, rumors and ugliness proliferated. One California barbershop offered free shaves for Japs, but added, "not responsible for accidents." A funeral parlor announced, "I'd rather do business with a Jap than an American." California Attorney General Earl Warren led the charge to remove Japanese Americans from the western states. Warren warned that the Japanese in Southern California might be the Achilles heel of the entire civil defense effort. Lieutenant Colonel John L. DeWitt, commander of the Fourth Army and head of the Western Defense Command, who had worked on the 1921 War Plans Division strategy to intern all enemy aliens on the islands of Hawaii, seconded Warren's efforts. On December 9th, DeWitt announced that Japanese warplanes had flown over San Francisco the previous night, and the city was in imminent danger of Japanese attack. DeWitt told a Civil Defense Council meeting, "Death and destruction are likely to come to this city any moment." Rear Admiral John Greenslade informed the audience that they had been saved from a terrible catastrophe by the grace of God. Why bombs were not dropped, DeWitt admitted, I do not know. One reason might have been that the Japanese flyover never occurred, which might also explain why U.S. forces never shot down any of the planes, and why the Army's and Navy's searches for the Japanese aircraft carriers came up empty. But DeWitt was furious with San Franciscans who did not take the blackout orders seriously enough, denouncing them as inane, idiotic, and foolish, and threatened, "If I can't knock these facts into your heads with words, I will have to turn you over to the police to let them knock them into you with clubs." DeWitt's mistrust of San Franciscans was benign. His mistrust of Japanese was pathological. DeWitt had initially characterized talk of large-scale evacuations as damned nonsense, but public pressure continued to mount, reinforced by the late January release of a government report on the bombing of Pearl Harbor that was prepared by Supreme Court Justice Owen Roberts. Espionage, the report alleged, had facilitated the attack. While most of the information was conveyed by Japanese consular agents, other Hawaiians of Japanese descent also played a role. The report reinforced public doubts about the loyalty of Japanese Americans. The resulting outcry apparently changed DeWitt into a passionate advocate of relocation. DeWitt argued that the fact that the Japanese, citizens and non-citizens alike, had not engaged in sabotage proved that they were plotting a future assault. Others, including Stimson and McCloy, echoed his sentiments, pressuring Roosevelt to take action before it was too late. Defectors from the Japs Can't Be Trusted line included one very unlikely individual, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover told Attorney General Francis Biddle that mass evacuations weren't necessary. All known security risks had already been rounded up. Biddle informed Roosevelt that there were no reasons for mass evacuations. Roosevelt ignored their advice. Despite the fact that there was no evidence of Japanese-American sabotage, on February 19, 1942, Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which laid the groundwork for the evacuation and incarceration of Japanese and Japanese-Americans from California, Oregon, and Washington, two-thirds of whom were U.S. citizens by birth. Although the executive order made no explicit mention of race or ethnicity, its intended target population was unmistakable. U.S. authorities abandoned the sweeping evacuation plans made for Hawaii's large Japanese population when wealthy white sugar cane and pineapple plantation owners complained that they would lose their labor force. However, the government did impose martial law, suspend the writ of habeas corpus, and locked up some 2,000 kibei, people of Japanese descent who had visited Japan for education and acculturation. On the mainland, especially in California, where the Japanese represented only slightly above 2% of the population, the situation was very different. Executive Order 9066 forced some 120,000 to evacuate their homes and settle outside the prohibited defense zones. But their entry was blocked by surrounding states. The governor of Idaho, Chase Clark, spewed, "The Japs live like rats, breed like rats, and act like rats. We don't want them." The governor of Wyoming warned that if the Japanese were moved to his state, there would be Japs hanging from every pine tree. The attorney general of Idaho recommended that all Japanese be put in concentration camps. "We want to keep this a white man's country." By February 25, 1942, the FBI had incarcerated all adult males of Japanese ancestry on Terminal Island, California. The U.S. Navy gave all other residents of Japanese ancestry 48 hours to clear out. Between March and October 1942, the Wartime Civil Control Administration, WCCA, opened temporary camps, known as assembly centers, to hold Japanese inmates, who were registered in given numbers. In Santa Anita and Tanforan, California, families were housed in horse stables, a single stall accommodating 5 or 6 people. They were later moved to more permanent relocation centers, referred to at the time as concentration camps. Conditions in the camps were deplorable. They often lacked running water, bathroom facilities, decent schools, insulated cabins, and proper roofs. The camps did, however, have adequate barbed wire fencing, machine gun installations, and guard towers. Appalled by the treatment of the prisoners, Milton Eisenhower resigned as director of the War Relocation Authority, WRA. Some Westerners were motivated by greed in supporting the evacuations. Because evacuees were allowed to take away only what they could carry, their former neighbors eagerly bought their property at a fraction of its real value, or seized what was left behind, including abandoned crops. A leader of the Grower Shipper Vegetable Association of Central California admitted, "We're charged with wanting to get rid of the Japs for selfish reasons. We might as well be honest. We do. It's a question of whether the white man lives on the Pacific coast or the brown man." The Japanese lost an estimated $400 million in personal property, worth perhaps $5.4 billion today. Starting in March 1942, the War Relocation Authority moved prisoners to 10 hastily constructed relocation centers in Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming. The Poston and Gila River relocation centers in Arizona soon housed populations of 17,814 and 13,348, respectively, making them the third and fourth largest cities in the state virtually overnight. Heart Mountain became the third largest city in Wyoming. Inside the camps, Japanese toiled under scorching desert sun in Arizona and California, swamp-like conditions in Arkansas, and bitter cold in Wyoming, Idaho, and Utah, and were paid a paltry $12 per month for unskilled labor and $19 for skilled. Japanese doctors earned $228 per year, while a white senior medical officer earned $4,600. White nurses who earned $80 per month at Yellowstone County Hospital received $150 at Heart Mountain, 8 to 10 times as much as their Japanese counterparts. Federal authorities sent photographers Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange to capture images of daily camp life, instructing them to take no photos showing barbed wire, watchtowers, or armed soldiers. Still, Adams, Lange, and a Japanese inmate, Toyo Miyataki, captured a few of the banned images. In February 1943, the U.S. government pulled a shameless about-face. Needing more manpower to fight the war, Roosevelt called upon American-born Nisei to join the segregated 442nd Regimental Combat Team, in conjunction with the 100th Battalion Hawaii, already stationed in Camp Shelby, Mississippi. The One Puka Puka, as the Hawaiian members called their unit, had volunteered early in the war and had had to struggle long and hard to be recognized as worthy to serve. The 442nd Regiment became one of the most decorated units in U.S. military history, fighting bravely in Italy and France and suffering 1,072 casualties, including 216 deaths in October 1944. That Japanese Americans were capable of such sacrifice for their country was apparently beyond the comprehension of the head of the Western Defense Command. In April 1943, DeWitt told the House Naval Affairs Subcommittee that he wasn't worried about Germans or Italians, but the Japs we will be worried about all the time until they are wiped off the face of the map. A Jap's a Jap, he informed them, whether a U.S. citizen or not. DeWitt's racist remarks rankled the Washington Post, which shot back, "The general should be told that American democracy and the Constitution of the United States are too vital to be ignored and flouted by any military zealot. Whatever excuse there once was for evacuating and holding them indiscriminately, no longer exists." Many Americans agreed. Some drew parallels with Nazi policies, although the differences, admittedly, were much greater than the similarities. In June 1942, Christian Century wrote, "The whole policy of resort to concentration camps is headed toward the destruction of constitutional rights and toward the establishment of racial discrimination as a principle of American government. It is moving in the same direction Germany moved." Eugene V., Victor Debs, Rostow, published a scathing piece in the Yale Law Journal in 1945, arguing, "We believe that the German people bear a common political responsibility for outrages secretly committed by the Gestapo and the SS. What are we to think of our own part in a program which violates every democratic social value, yet has been approved by the Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court?" In June 1943, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in the government's favor in the first two cases to come before it. Although the ruling in Hirabayashi v. United States did not address the fundamental issues of evacuation and incarceration, Justice Frank Murphy's concurring opinion came very close to doing so. "To say that any group cannot be assimilated is to admit that the great American experiment has failed. Today is the first time, so far as I am aware, that we have sustained a substantial restriction of the personal liberty of citizens of the United States based upon the accident of race or ancestry. In this sense, it bears a melancholy resemblance to the treatment accorded to members of the Jewish race in Germany and in other parts of Europe." On January 2nd, 1945, the WRA ended forced incarceration, but provided little assistance as prisoners tried to rebuild their shattered lives. Some decided to migrate as far away from the West Coast as possible. According to the National Park Service, the Japanese received only $25 per person, a train ticket, and meals en route for those with less than $500 in cash. It was not until the passage of the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1952 that many of the older Japanese, the Issei, were deemed fit to be citizens. Moreover, it took over 40 years for a national apology and monetary redress of $1.5 billion for survivors of the incarceration centers. The United States' moral threshold, particularly its indifference to inflicting civilian casualties on a massive scale, had also been dramatically lowered by years of bombing civilian populations, particularly in the air war against Japan. Urban area bombing had begun during the First World War. The Germans, British, French, Italians, and Austrians had all bombed one another's cities, and some of this continued in brutal fashion during the interwar period. To its credit, the United States strongly condemned the Japanese bombing of Chinese cities in 1937. When the war began in Europe in 1939, Roosevelt implored the combatants to refrain from the inhuman barbarism involved in bombing defenseless civilians. Undeterred, Germany began bombing British cities. The British responded with 1,000-plane bombing raids on urban targets in Germany. By the mid-1940s, great cities such as Barcelona, Madrid, Shanghai, Beijing, Nanjing, Warsaw, London, Rotterdam, Moscow, Stalingrad, Leningrad, Cologne, Hamburg, Berlin, and many others had been severely bombed. The United States, by contrast, concentrated almost entirely on precision bombing of key industries and transportation networks until late in the European War. In August 1942, Captain Paul Tibbets, who would later pilot the B-29 that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, expressed apprehension at the possibility of causing civilian casualties as he prepared to lead the first daytime raid by U.S. bombers against German targets in occupied France. He told a reporter that he felt sick with thoughts of the civilians who might suffer from the bombs dropped by this machine. Watching the bombs fall, he thought, "My God, women and children are getting killed." But as the war continued, American scruples began to soften. The October 1943 area bombing raid on Munster was an important turning point. The most tragic exception to the earlier standards was U.S. participation in the Allied bombing of Dresden in February 1945. The United States adopted a far more ruthless bombing policy in Japan. When Major General Haywood Hanzel, head of the 21st Bomber Command, resisted orders to use incendiaries against large urban areas, Air Force General Henry Hap Arnold replaced him with General Curtis LeMay. Nicknamed Iron Ass by his men because he was so relentless and demanding, LeMay had made his reputation in the air war in Europe. In Japan, he revolutionized bombing tactics and took what was already being referred to as terror bombing to an entirely different level. On the night of March 9th to 10th, 1945, LeMay sent 334 planes to attack Tokyo with incendiary bombs, consisting of napalm, thermite, white phosphorus, and other inflammable materials. The bombs destroyed 16 square miles, killing perhaps 100,000 people and injuring even more. The scalding inferno caused canals to boil, metal to melt, and people to burst into flames spontaneously. The victims, LeMay reported, were scorched and boiled and baked to death. By May, 75% of bombs dropped were incendiaries designed to burn down Japan's paper cities. According to Japanese scholar Yuki Tanaka, the United States firebombed over 100 Japanese cities. Destruction reached 99.5% in the city of Toyama, driving Secretary of War Henry Stimson to tell Truman that he did not want to have the U.S. get the reputation of outdoing Hitler in atrocities, though Stimson did almost nothing to halt the slaughter. He had managed to delude himself into believing Arnold's promise that he would limit damage to civilians. Future Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara, who was on LeMay's staff in 1945, agreed with his boss's comment that if the United States lost the war, they'd all be tried as war criminals and deserved to be convicted. Hatred toward the Japanese ran so deep that almost no one objected to the mass slaughter of civilians. Oppenheimer recalled Stimson's disappointment over Americans' indifference. "I remember Mr. Stimson saying to me that he thought it appalling that there should be no protest over the air raids which we were conducting against Japan, which in the case of Tokyo led to such extraordinarily heavy loss of life. He didn't say that the airstrikes shouldn't be carried on, but he did think there was something wrong with a country where no one questioned that." Brigadier General Bonner Fellers called it one of the most ruthless and barbaric killings of non-combatants in all history. Arnold felt that 90% of Americans would have killed every Japanese. General Groves's target committee decided that the atomic bombs would be dropped on military facilities surrounded by workers' homes in previously unbombed cities. The committee decided to make the initial use so spectacular that people everywhere would appreciate the weapon's significance. When members of Stimson's interim committee, which examined a number of issues surrounding the use of the atomic bombs, raised alternatives, including a demonstration, Burns, as Truman's personal representative on the committee, overrode them. At its May 31st meeting, the interim committee also addressed the future of nuclear weapons. Scientists understood that the bombs under production were the most rudimentary, primitive prototypes of what was to follow. The prospect terrified them. Oppenheimer informed the nation's top military and civilian officials that within 3 years the United States could have weapons of between 10 and 100 megatons, potentially almost 7,000 times as powerful as the bomb that would soon be dropped on Hiroshima. In late May, Szilard, Nobel Prize-winning chemist Harold Urey, and astronomer Walter Bartke attempted to see Truman to caution against using the bomb. They were rerouted to Spartanburg, South Carolina, to speak with Burns, whose response appalled Szilard. Mr. Burns did not argue that it was necessary to use the bomb against the cities of Japan in order to win the war. He knew at that time, as the rest of the government knew, that Japan was essentially defeated. At that time, Mr. Burns was much concerned about the spreading of Russian influence in Europe, insisting that our possessing and demonstrating the bomb would make Russia more manageable in Europe. Groves also admitted that in his mind, the Soviet Union had always been the enemy. "There was never, from about 2 weeks from the time I took charge of this project, any illusion on my part that Russia was our enemy, and the project was conducted on that basis." Groves shocked Joseph Rotblat when he said over dinner in March 1944, "You realize, of course, that the main purpose of this project is to subdue the Russians." Burns's and Groves's statements shed crucial light on Burns's April 13th remark to Truman that the atomic bomb might well put us in a position to dictate our own terms at the end of the war. While Los Alamos scientists worked feverishly to complete the bomb, others began to have doubts about the wisdom of what they had done. In June, Chicago Met Lab scientists set up a series of committees to explore various aspects of atomic energy. The Committee on Social and Political Implications, chaired by the Nobel laureate James Franck, issued a report, greatly influenced by Leo Szilard, questioning the wisdom of using atomic bombs in the current war. It warned that a surprise attack on Japan would not only destroy the United States' moral position, it could instigate a nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union, spurred by the threat of total mutual destruction. The report also noted that, because there was no secret to the scientific principles behind the bomb, the Soviet Union would soon catch up. Szilard understood the dangers better than anyone else. He desperately attempted to prevent the bomb's use. He circulated the Franck Committee report to scientists at other laboratories. After security officers had it classified and banned its circulation, Szilard drew up a petition warning the president. "The atomic bombs at our disposal represent only the first step in this direction, and there is almost no limit to the destructive power which will become available in the course of their future development. Thus, a nation which sets the precedent of using these newly liberated forces of nature for the purposes of destruction may have to bear the responsibility of opening the door to an era of devastation on an unimaginable scale." 155 scientists at Chicago's Met Lab and the uranium plant in Oak Ridge signed the petition. Oppenheimer banned its circulation at Los Alamos and alerted Groves, who made sure it didn't reach Stimson and Truman until it was too late to stop the bomb's use. Groves's security agents had been conducting extensive surveillance of Szilard throughout the war. At one point, Groves went so far as to draft a letter to the Attorney General, labeling Szilard an enemy alien, and requesting that he be interned for the duration of the war. Fortunately, Compton persuaded him not to send it. Groves ordered his own poll among scientists, and was chagrined to see that 83% favored demonstrating the bomb before using it against Japan. He hushed up the results. Others also tried to prevent the bomb's use, but sadly had no more success than Szilard. On June 27th, Undersecretary of the Navy Ralph Bard, the Navy representative to the Interim Committee, wrote Stimson a memo stating, "During recent weeks, I have also had the feeling very definitely that the Japanese government may be searching for some opportunity which they could use as a medium of surrender." He urged that the United States, as a great humanitarian nation, warn Japan about the Soviet entry into the war and the development of the atomic bomb, and clarify the surrender terms. Some historians believe that after leaving the government a few days later, Bard met with the president to press those points, but the record is ambiguous. It is clear, however, that when Truman met with the Joint Chiefs on June 18th, Assistant Secretary of War John McCloy recommended that he tell the Japanese that they would be permitted to retain the emperor and a form of government of their own choosing, and that we had another and terrifyingly destructive weapon which we would have to use if they did not surrender. Things came to a head when Allied leaders gathered in Potsdam, a suburb of bombed-out Berlin. The target date for the first atomic bombing was less than a month away. Truman arrived on July 15th, nervously anticipating his first meeting with Churchill and Stalin. Reports poured in confirming the Japanese desire to quit if allowed to surrender conditionally. The evidence the top U.S. officials recognized the signals emanating from Tokyo is unassailable. Truman unambiguously characterized the intercepted July 18th cable that stated, "Unconditional surrender is the only obstacle to peace," as "the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace." Forrestal wrote about evidence of a Japanese desire to get out of the war, Stimson about Japanese maneuverings for peace, and Burns about Japanese peace feelers. In his 1966 book, The Secret Surrender, OSS official and later CIA head Alan Dulles recalled, "I went to the Potsdam conference and reported there to Secretary Stimson on what I had learned from Tokyo. They desired to surrender if they could retain the emperor and the constitution as a basis for maintaining discipline and order in Japan after the devastating news of surrender became known to the Japanese people." The Pacific Strategic Intelligence Summary for the week of the Potsdam meeting reported, "It may be said that Japan now, officially if not publicly, recognizes her defeat. Abandoning as unobtainable the long-cherished goal of victory, she has turned to the twin aims of A, reconciling national pride with defeat, and B, finding the best means of salvaging the wreckage of her ambitions." As the head of the War Department Operations Division Policy Section, Colonel Charles Tick Bonesteel recalled, "The poor damn Japanese were putting feelers out by the ton." Truman's principal reason for going to Potsdam, he claimed, was to make sure the Soviets were coming into the war as promised. Knowing that their entry would deliver the final crushing blow, he rejoiced when Stalin reassured him, writing in his diary on July 17th, "He'll be in the Jap War on August 15th. Finny Japs when that comes about." The next day, Truman wrote to Bess, "We'll end the war a year sooner now, and think of the kids who won't be killed." Truman had one more card to play, but the timing had to be precise. Stimson understood that. He wrote in his diary on May 15th that the bomb was a crucial diplomatic tool, but that it wouldn't be tested before Potsdam. "We think it will be shortly afterwards, but it seems a terrible thing to gamble with such big stakes in diplomacy without having your master card in your hand." Truman had pushed the start of the summit back 2 weeks and hoped the bomb would be tested before negotiations with Stalin began. Oppenheimer confessed, "We were under incredible pressure to get it done before the Potsdam meeting. It turned out, from Truman's perspective, to be worth the wait." On July 16th, while Truman was touring Berlin and preparing for the next day's meeting with Stalin, scientists exploded the first atomic bomb in the desert outside Alamogordo, New Mexico. The Trinity test exceeded expectations. Given the enormous power of the 18.6 kiloton blast and the brightness of the sky, some scientists feared that they had indeed set the atmosphere on fire. Oppenheimer said that a phrase from the Bhagavad Gita flashed through his mind. "I am become death, destroyer of worlds." Deputy Director Kenneth Bainbridge put it more simply, "Now we're all sons of bitches." Groves cabled the preliminary results to Stimson, who rushed to brief Truman and Burns. They were elated. On July 21st, Groves sent a much fuller and more dramatic report, which stated, "The test was successful beyond the most optimistic expectations of anyone." Groves estimated the energy released to be equivalent to 15 to 20 kilotons of TNT, an amount that so far exceeded anything previously achieved, that it was almost inconceivable. Stimson read it to the President and Secretary of State. Along with Groves's report came one by Brigadier General Thomas Farrell, who described a strong, sustained, awesome roar which warned of doomsday. When Churchill read this report, he exclaimed, "This is the second coming in wrath." Truman, Burns, and Groves believed they now had a way to speed Japanese surrender on U.S. terms without Soviet help, and thereby deny the Soviet Union the promised territorial and economic concessions. Stimson observed, "The President was tremendously pepped up by the report, and spoke to me of it again and again when I saw him. He said it gave him an entirely new feeling of confidence." Truman, who had allowed Churchill and Stalin to dominate the early sessions, now rode roughshod over the proceedings. Winston Churchill described the scene at the next plenary session. "I couldn't understand it. When he got to the meeting after having read this report, he was a changed man. He told the Russians just where they got on and off and generally bossed the whole meeting." McCloy, too, noted the role the bomb played in bucking up Truman's confidence. "Throughout it all, the big bomb is playing its part. It has stiffened both the Prime Minister and the President. After getting Groves' report, they went to the next meeting like little boys with a big red apple secreted on their persons." Though never able to stand up to his father or Boss Pendergast or the other bullies, Truman could now stand up to Stalin himself. If, as was said, the revolver made old men 6 feet tall, the successful atomic bomb test made the diminutive Truman a giant, who towered over the world's most fearsome dictators. But Truman's public bravado masked a deeper understanding of the world he was about to usher in with the use of the atomic bomb. He wrote in his Potsdam diary, "We have discovered the most terrible bomb in the history of the world. It may be the fire destruction prophesied in the Euphrates Valley era, after Noah and his fabulous ark." Unfortunately, Truman's apocalyptic forebodings did not impel him to seek alternatives as the day of reckoning approached. Unlike the other principal decision-makers, Truman, Burns, and Groves, Stimson did have serious misgivings about using the atomic bomb. He referred to it as the dreadful, the terrible, the dire, the awful, and the diabolical. He considered it not merely a new weapon, but a revolutionary change in the relations of man to the universe that might even mean the doom of civilization. It might be a Frankenstein which would eat us up. He tried repeatedly to convince Truman and Burns to assure the Japanese about the Emperor, but trying to convince them was an exercise in futility. When Stimson complained to Truman about being ignored on this point at Potsdam, Truman told his elderly, frail Secretary of War that if he didn't like it, he could pack his bags and go home. At Potsdam, Stimson informed General Dwight Eisenhower, the supreme Allied commander, that the bomb's use was imminent. Eisenhower reacted strongly. He described his response in a Newsweek interview. "So then he told me they were going to drop it on the Japanese. Well, I listened, and I didn't volunteer anything because, after all, my war was over in Europe, and it wasn't up to me. But I was getting more and more depressed just thinking about it. Then he asked for my opinion, so I told him I was against it on two counts. First, the Japanese were ready to surrender, and it wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing. Second, I hated to see our country be the first to use such a weapon." Eisenhower told historian Stephen Ambrose that he had expressed his opposition directly to Truman and his top advisors. Historian Barton Bernstein finds reason to doubt Eisenhower's account, but General Omar Bradley supports Ike's version. Now that the bomb had been successfully tested, Truman, Burns, and Stimson no longer welcomed the Soviet Union's entry into the war, which would entitle the Soviets to the concessions Roosevelt had promised at Yalta. Churchill observed on July 23rd, "It is quite clear that the United States do not at the present time desire Russian participation in the war against Japan." Burns acknowledged, "Neither the President nor I were anxious to have them enter the war after we had learned of this successful test." He explained to his assistant, Walter Brown, that he was hoping for time, believing that after the atomic bomb, Japan will surrender and Russia will not get in so much on the kill. For Truman and his advisors, the way to accomplish this seemed obvious. Use the atomic bomb. Truman spelled it out. "Believe Japs will fold up before Russia comes in. I am sure they will when Manhattan appears over their homeland." Before the conference ended, Truman sidled up to Stalin and casually mentioned that the United States had developed a new weapon of unusual destructive force. Unaware that Soviet intelligence had kept Stalin informed of the Manhattan Project, Truman was surprised by his seemingly disinterested response and wondered if Stalin had grasped what he was telling him. Stalin understood far more than Truman realized. He knew that the test had been scheduled. Now he concluded that it had succeeded. He immediately phoned Soviet security and secret police chief Lavrenty Beria and berated him for not having known that the test had occurred. Andrei Gromyko reported that when Stalin returned to his villa, he remarked that the Americans would use their atomic monopoly to dictate terms in Europe, but that he wouldn't give in to their blackmail. He ordered Soviet military forces to speed the country's entry into the war, and he ordered Soviet scientists to pick up the pace of their research. Truman never issued a direct order to drop the bomb. At Potsdam, on July 25th, he approved a directive signed by Stimson and Marshall ordering that the atomic bombs be used as soon after August 3rd as weather permitted. He knew there was little chance that the final Potsdam Declaration, which contained neither a significant modification of surrender terms, a warning about the bomb, or notice of Soviet entry into the war would be accepted by Japan. Still, it is important to note that contrary to later claims by Truman and Stimson, the authorization was given before, not after, the Japanese rejected the Potsdam Declaration. Truman did not invite Stalin to sign the declaration, even though Stalin came intending to sign it and even brought a draft of his own. Stalin's signature would have notified the Japanese that the Soviet Union was about to come into the war. The absence of his signature encouraged the Japanese to continue their futile efforts to gain Soviet assistance in securing better surrender terms, while the hours ticked off until the bomb was ready to use. Truman's behavior at Potsdam reinforced Stalin's belief that the United States intended to end the war quickly and renege on its promised concessions. During the conference, he told Truman that Soviet troops would be ready to attack by the middle of August. Soviet Chief of Staff Alexei Antonov informed his U.S. counterparts that the actual start date was more likely the end of the month. Stalin ordered Marshal Alexander Vasilevsky to prepare to invade 10 to 14 days earlier. Although Truman always took responsibility for the decision, Groves, who had drafted the July 25th memo, contended that Truman didn't really decide.